world peace might feel kind of like a pipe dream, but what if I told you it's not? 2024 will see more than 50 elections around the world, and in some places, peace is actually on the ballot. One reason is because countries in Europe and Latin America have been experimenting with this thing called feminist foreign policy. Because right now, the way that we wage war and peace, it's kind of a boys' club. The new season of Things That Go Boom from Inkstick Media and PRX is coming March 18th. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
The Economist. Hello and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. I'm Jason Palmer.
And I'm Ora Ogunbiyi. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world.
8 years after the narrow vote in favor of Brexit, Britain's mood has shifted. Well over half the country reckons that leaving the European Union was a mistake. And that means that even after all this time, Brexit can still influence voters.
And whales might be the biggest mammals on the planet, but ships still don't always manage to dodge them, further threatening an already endangered species. Could new tech help? First up, though. Palestinian demonstrators are still camped out at Columbia University in New York, despite the passing of a midnight deadline to disband. Tents had sprung back up after the city's police were called in last week to clear the site, arresting more than 100 students in the process. That firestorm has now spread, with other encampments being set up across the country. The demands by student protesters are largely the same. Divest endowments of Israeli firms and any weapons manufacturers that sell there, end academic partnerships with Israeli institutions, and condemn Israel's actions in the war.
Oh, you obviously just want a free Palestine. You know, we want Columbia to stop funding the harm that is happening to Palestinian people.
Many are concerned about an undercurrent of anti-Semitism that they say exists in the protests. And it's left those in charge, expected to protect free speech on campuses, in a quandary.
Being the president of an American university used to be a really plum, prestigious job, but it's a tough time now to be leading one of America's elite universities.
Daniel Franklin is The Economist's US deputy editor.
The presidents of both Harvard and University of Pennsylvania resigned a few months ago after a very timid and lackluster appearance in Congress, answering questions about anti-Semitism on campus. And what we're seeing now is university leaders responding to the troubles earlier on in the year and showing a tougher face. And the danger is that they overreact.
Daniel, tell us about these latest protests.
Well, the trigger for the latest trouble was really the decision last week at Columbia University to send in the New York Police Department to clear away an encampment on campus. And that led to a lot of arrests. It's led to copycat encampments elsewhere and police crackdowns. And it's fired up a lot of opposition to what some see as very heavy-handed and overzealous attempts to enforce college rules. The irony is that by involving the police instead of quelling the trouble, it seems to be galvanizing it.
I mean, I didn't really know what was going to happen after we got arrested, but we thought it was getting shut down. And then when we heard that students pulled up to the other lawn, I didn't even know that was a possibility.
In no time, another encampment sprung up on a nearby lawn at Columbia.
It's clear that people are aligned with us and our movement, and that our strength is only growing.
And tent encampments have popped up far beyond Columbia at universities around the country.
What has the response been from universities?
Universities seem to be prepared to take a tougher line. Columbia's president, Manoush Shafiq, said she asked the police to intervene after all other efforts had failed. So administrators seem to be overcoming generally their reluctance to call in the cops. At Yale, there were more than 50 arrests after police were called in. At New York University, police also broke up a copycat encampment with several more arrests.
So they're taking a tougher line now, but these protests aren't new, right? How have the university authorities been dealing with protests relating to the war in Gaza up until now?
I think the short answer is rather inconsistent application of university rules, a hesitant approach, and that was very much in evidence at the congressional hearings in December. Some universities have banned pro-Palestinian organizations and curtailed events that looked as if they might get unruly. Two pressure groups were suspended last year by Columbia for organizing unauthorized demonstrations, and the New York Civil Liberties Union has sued over that move. And there have been controversial moves elsewhere. At the University of Southern California, the graduation speech of its pro-Palestinian valedictorian, who's Muslim, was cancelled, and following the controversy that surrounded that, the university cancelled all commencement speeches, which is hardly an advertisement for free speech. And the problem for university administrators is that they really face so many competing pressures.
What are those competing pressures, Daniel?
Well, they clearly face pressures from politicians, donors, faculty, as well as, of course, from students. On April the 17th, Dr. Shafiq at Columbia became the latest president to be grilled by the House Education Committee about her university's handling of anti-Semitism on campus.
I just want to confirm that when faculty behave in any discriminatory fashion at Columbia,
you talk to them.
There are consequences. No, we take them out of the classroom if necessary. We
is he out of the classroom?
From leadership posts if necessary. We allow students to leave those classes if they feel at all uncomfortable.
Is he out of the classroom?
Unlike the presidents of Harvard and the University of Pennsylvania who fumbled their appearances last December, Dr. Shafiq survived the grilling, at least for now, but critics say she didn't go nearly far enough to stand up for free speech. Politicians, including Elise Stefanik, congresswoman who has been leading the charge on this call for her resignation, and to several others. So although the politicians are supposedly concerned about the climate on campus, they actually make the job of administrators even harder by acting as antagonists themselves.
Are there any signs of American campuses returning to normal before the end of the semester?
That doesn't look very likely. The Columbia campus has sprung back into protest despite the police action, and it's now disrupting life for the majority of students who are not taking part in protests. The classes have been switched to virtual, and many professors are staging what might be called a virtual walkout in solidarity. There are helicopters buzzing above, police lines present nearby, causing disruption for those students who are trying to take exams or test exams, for example, for the MCAT medical exams. And I think one political question is not just whether it ends on campus with the end of this semester, but whether the trouble continues into the summer and through to the Democratic National Convention in Chicago in August, and that will have strong echoes of the Democrats' National Convention back in 1968, which was marred by protesters struggling on campus that year for racial justice and against the Vietnam War, which culminated in a police crackdown and more than 700 arrests, and then led to a very riotous National Convention that year. So could something similar happen this year in Chicago for the Democrats? That's obviously something that Joe Biden will be incredibly keen to avoid.
Daniel, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ari.
With the highest number of young STEM graduates per capita in the EU, Ireland has the people and skills your company needs to succeed here. IDEA Ireland, the National Investment Development Agency, can help you find and nurture the people you need to internationalize and thrive. Our talent is just one of the extraordinary benefits Ireland has to offer. Learn more at IDEAIreland.com. Invest in extraordinary.
It's pretty rare for voters to change their minds once a referendum is run and won. In fact, from Canada to Scotland, Norway to Switzerland, voters in lots of polls have moved toward the winning result rather than away from it. But Brexit seems to be an exception to that rule.
You know, so I did vote for Brexit, but with hindsight, if I could change my vote, I would change it now.
I mean, the government lied to us. In fairness, they did lie to us. They never told us the truth. Most of us that voted for Brexit, we wouldn't have voted if we had known that we're going to be going through all this stuff.
In June 2016, Britons voted 52-48% in favour of leaving the European Union. But since then, the numbers have shifted. These days, a pretty strong majority of voters say, correctly, that Brexit was a bad call.
The strongest vote for Brexit in 2016 came from older voters, while younger ones tended to want to stay in the EU.
John Peat, for a tricky few years there, was our Brexit editor. Now he does other stuff.
As demography changes, as older people pass on and younger people become part of the electorate, it swings the balance more in favour of saying actually it was a mistake to vote to leave the EU. But that isn't the whole story with what's happened in the last 8 years. There have been some Leave voters who change their minds and think actually it was a mistake to vote to leave.
Now, we've been talking about these numbers in some detail, well, since the vote happened, a little bit of buyer's remorse not long after, but what do the numbers look like today?
Well, going by the regular polls from organisations like YouGov, put together by UK in a Changing Europe think tank, something like 16-20% of those who voted Leave in 2016 now think that was a mistake. And against that, no more than about 5 or 6% who voted Remain in 2016 have changed their minds and think they should have voted Leave. So that margin has swung the majority quite strongly to the view that voting to Leave was a mistake, combined, obviously, with the change in the electorate.
And so what's behind that sort of collective change of heart?
Well, as part of my research, I decided to look at two constituencies that have the same name by coincidence, Richmond-on-Thames near London and Richmond in Yorkshire. And I just talked to quite a number of random people in both places. I got the impression in Richmond-on-Thames, which voted quite strongly to remain in the European Union, that most people still think that Remain was a better choice, that there is dissatisfaction with niggles like trade problems, passport problems, visa problems with the European Union. So mostly the people there who voted Remain feel strongly that Remain should have won. They're still quite angry about it. In Richmond in Yorkshire, I met more people naturally who voted Leave because it was a place that did vote very heavily for Leave. And two or three of the people I met did say they voted Leave not quite knowing what would happen, and if they did it again, they might want to know much more about what would happen and why it would take so long to sort out leaving the European Union. Others, particularly connected with farming, said that farmers have had a tough time since the Brexit vote because they've lost some of the benefits of subsidies through the European Union. But I think generally, in both places, a feeling that the economy is not doing very well suggests that those who voted for Brexit, hoping to see economic benefits, they have been disappointed. Those who also voted for Brexit, hoping to see immigration reduced, have been disappointed because actually it's risen. It hasn't fallen since 2016. And a general dissatisfaction with the Conservative government under Rishi Sunak has also translated a bit into the feeling that maybe Brexit was a mistake. So I think those are the sort of feelings I got when I visited those two places.
But how do you unpick those things that are the fault of Brexit and things that are entirely unconnected and people are just disgruntled voters?
I think that's very difficult. We've had not just Brexit, but we've had COVID, which upset the economy. We've then had the invasion of Ukraine, which has caused trouble, that pushed up energy prices. So I think there is a general feeling that the last few years have not been very good ones for the British people. But some of that is linked in people's minds to the decision to leave the European Union. They don't feel that there have been significant benefits from leaving the European Union. And in some cases, especially those leavers who've changed their minds, they actually see some disadvantages in terms of restrictions on travel and making it hard to move around in Europe.
So is that to say, with the upcoming elections in Britain, that Brexit is still going to have some effect on people's voting intentions? Are people still voting about Brexit?
No, I think Brexit has generally fallen a bit off the political agenda. I mean, if you look at polling results, people are very worried about the economy, they're very worried about the NHS, they're very worried about the state of the public services, and they worry about immigration and so on, and house prices, all the usual things. The actual issue of Brexit is much lower profile now. But I think that there is some evidence that people associate the decision to leave the European Union, particularly with the Conservative Party under Rishi Sunak, who's a very keen Brexiteer. And insofar as that makes a difference, I think it does actually reduce the appeal of the Conservative Party to ordinary voters, because they think they took us into this problem of leaving the European Union. If we now think maybe that was a mistake, that makes us less inclined to vote Conservative. Meanwhile, the Labour Party is very careful to say nothing at all about Brexit, but they are letting it be known that they would try to improve relations with the European Union, which I think is generally quite a sensible position to take.
But does the Labour position, you think, stretch as far as another referendum to get back in?
There is not great enthusiasm now for restarting the whole debate about Britain's position in the European Union, because people felt it was very painful and it was very long drawn out, and nobody much enjoyed the process of actually leaving the European Union. But attitudes towards the EU have certainly changed, and the feeling that it was probably not a good idea to leave is generally quite a strong one now. A Labour government that looks likely after the next election is suddenly going to have to look at the issue of where Britain sits in relation to the EU. They say they don't want to rejoin. They don't want to rejoin the single market. They don't even want to rejoin the customs union with the European Union. But they are going to have to debate and consider getting much closer to the European Union than we are today. And I think that process could ultimately lead to a rethink about the whole issue of Britain's position inside Europe.
John, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
The calls of whales have echoed in the ocean for about 50 million years. They tell the stories of mammals that have survived big threats before. Most recently, commercial whaling. Soon after that ended, a new danger emerged. Ship strikes are now killing up to 20,000 whales annually. And as global ocean traffic continues to rise, the problem will balloon. The North Atlantic right whale is under particular threat, and the species can't sustain more losses. Only about 360 of them are left. But a new movement is trying to fight back.
There's a strike prevention group called Whale Safe, and they're trying to reduce the number of whale deaths from vessel strikes in California.
Emily Steinmark is a science correspondent for The Economist.
And they've been doing that for a small number of years, and now they're expanding their operations to America's East Coast, which is home to the very endangered North Atlantic right whale.
How does it work?
WhaleSafe uses technology to alert skippers and ships to whales in the area by giving them a probability of the whales that might be close to them. So they do this by listening underwater using buoys that are equipped with microphones. And these microphones listen for whale calls that can then be separated out by their low frequencies from the rest of the noise in the ocean. And these calls are then fed into WhaleSafe's alert tool to tell these nearby ships to remember to slow down in special slowdown zones. The team also publishes the names of the companies that don't comply with the speed limits, as well as those that, you know, make an effort to, by giving all companies a grade that reflects how often they slow down and how well they do in general.
And Emily, has it worked in California?
Well, it's quite hard to say because they think that there are really large shadow numbers. So most of the time when a ship hits a whale, nobody reports it, and that whale is just dead in the sea. It might float for a bit and then sink. But what they can say is that since WhaleSafe first launched, reported collisions in California seem to be going down. There were only four in 2022 compared with 11 the year before. And now that technology is being used in other places too. However, experts like Mark Baumgartner, who really pioneered this idea of acoustic buoys and gliders, which are these autonomous robots that dive through the sea whilst they listen for whales, he thinks that whale monitoring technology on its own is probably not quite enough.
So I'm glad we have this, but if it's not used in the right way, it's likely not providing the protections that we had hoped it would.
Spotting a whale is useful only when the ship is going slowly enough to react. If it's hurtling towards a whale, even if it spotted it, it might not be able to actually swerve to the side or do anything to avoid that whale. But the real problem is that lots of the ships don't follow the speed rules because in many places they are voluntary restrictions. And when you have other goals to achieve and business ambitions, it might not be the whales that you're thinking about first.
So surely if they just made those speed restrictions mandatory in the areas where there were whales, then that might help?
Yes, and that's already happening in some places. Dr. Baumgartner told me about what they're doing in Canada, for example.
In Canada, they had a mandatory program. They used the same whale detection data from gliders using our system, and they have a mandatory program. If right whales are heard, everyone slows down, and it's enforced by Canadian equivalent of the Coast Guard and Transport Canada.
Other countries, like America, are considering expanding their own slowdown zones in similar ways. But it can be difficult to make these changes everywhere. Communities whose economies rely on their ports and harbors are more likely to resist stricter measures such as mandatory speed limits or no-go areas. But there is reason to hope that technologies and new initiatives can help pull species like the North Atlantic right whale back from the brink of extinction. They survived international commercial whaling, and maybe they can survive this too.
Emily, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. As always, you can let us know what you think of the show by emailing us at podcast@economist.com. And we'll see you back here tomorrow.
What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico is more than just a tropical paradise. It's an innovations paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, Puerto Rico has the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, this is the place to bring it. Find out more at investpr.org/economist.